go. You can't push it to the last category. I'm sorry. Yes. And he gives me the kind assurance that he wasn't beaten up by his wife. Good folks, welcome. The rest of the kissing and hugging you can do during tea time. I would like us to start with our first presentation. As told, it's University of Cape Town Law Clinic. Some people in this room also did service there in the refugee unit many years ago, so welcome. I'm sure you are aware that you have 30 minutes, 15 minutes for presentation, and plus minus 15 for presentation, and then the rest will ask members of parliament to pose questions and make comments. We are in your able hands, good folks.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. And good morning, committee members, and good morning, colleagues. My name is Tal Schreier. I'm one of the senior attorneys at the University of Cape Town Refugee Rights Project. And the Refugee Rights Project has been for over 10 years giving legal advice and services to refugees and migrants, and we're a UNHCR legal implementing partner in Cape Town, and I'm here with my colleague Fatima Khan. And first of all, I want to thank the committee for having giving us the opportunity to many of our civil society submissions and their concerns, and we're happy that they're here with us. And we particularly endorse the submissions of the Lawyers for Human Rights, the Law Society of South Africa, and CORMSA. And as well, just to let you know that we met yesterday with UNHCR Cape Town's office. They've raised similar concerns about this amendment bill to the at the ministerial level. We met with them yesterday, and we endorse and share the UNHCR's concerns about this bill as well. I'm going to try to be brief because I know that a lot of my colleagues are covering similar and additional, though, issues that this amendment bill is bringing forth. And there are clearly still gaps in the legislation, as we know. There's gaps in the Refugees Act. There's gaps in how the Immigration Act and the Refugees Act may or may not interact with each other. I think case in point is what we have now with the Zimbabwean Dispensation Project, and also the other highlights of the gaps of the legislation, which I have picked up in my colleagues' submissions, we endorse as well. But to get to the actual meat and potatoes of this hearing, the submissions about the amendment bill itself, we have a number of concerns. The first concern, or the primary issue that we would just like to state up front, is that the UCT Law Clinic several years ago participated in a thorough consultative process on the amendments to the Refugees Act, and this was preceding the Amendment Bill of 2008, which is now the Amendment Act of 2008, and that was a quite an intense civil society and government stakeholders consultation process. And I think the point is that prior to the Amendment Act of this year being shown to us, we haven't participated in a similar consultative process. And I think some of the issues that we have with the bill itself may very well be able to be explained by the Department of Home Affairs so that we understand their intentions of this bill, but we have not been given that opportunity. The memorandum of the bill speaks to things like the Status Determination Committee, and I'll get to these issues specifically, was created to deal with applications for asylum more efficiently, promptly, and in a less subjective fashion. We have no idea about the composition of the Status Determination Committee to be able to understand whether that's even possible. So let me go through briefly some of the main issues of concern that the universities, that our offices have picked up when we've reviewed this bill in detail. The first area of concern is the fact that manifestly unfounded applications have been reintroduced in this bill. In the 1998 Act, there was a provision for manifestly unfounded applications. In the 2008 Amendment Act, manifestly unfounded applications were removed, and then now the department has reintroduced the concept of manifestly unfounded applications and have also introduced a new process for reviewing these types of decisions. And that process, it stated that the Director General will review applications for that are rejected by as manifestly unfounded. And specifically, we, as I mentioned before, when we haven't been advised of the intentions of the drafters, we don't know what is entailed with this DG review process for reviewing such decisions, who the Director General will delegate his or her powers to for this purpose. Will it be an official? Will it be a quasi-judicial body? What necessary legal expertise will this body or entity have? As we know currently, there's a really large number of manifestly unfounded applications that are currently in a backlog, and many of the decisions coming out of refugee offices are manifestly unfounded. So there is a large number of applicants that are currently being rejected as manifestly unfounded. Will this new entity or this person be capacitated to effectively deal with such a large caseload? What will happen to the large caseload of manifestly unfounded applications that are currently with the Standing Committee of Refugee Affairs, for which submissions many of my colleagues and myself have made directly to the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs? Basically, we want to know what will be the prescribed manner of this review and want to make sure that it will follow a lawful, just, fair process that can be measured against PAJA, the PAJA and PAYA Act. The other main concern we have is about the Status Determination Committee that this bill proposes. The bill, like I said, the bill's accompanying memorandum stated that the Status Determination Committee will deal with applications for asylum efficiently and promptly and in a less subjective fashion. While that's very optimistic, we know of the many implementation problems that exist at ground level at refugee reception offices. So without any indication about what this status committee will look like and its prescribed manner and timeline for dealing with applications, it's hard to understand how this objective of the department in introducing this committee be accomplished. Specifically about the committee, we want to know what the composition of the committee will be, in what matter will the committee hear applications and render its decisions. It's further unclear what level of expertise and training the committee members would necessarily have to have. The bill has not indicated that at least one of the members of the committee should be legally qualified. We would argue that the committee should have that legal qualification and expertise in light of the fact that both the Act and this bill eliminate the current Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs, which was not only a quasi-judicial review body for manifestly unfounded, but it also served as an oversight body for the functioning and operations of the refugee reception offices. RSDOs had the opportunity to forward questions of law to the Standing Committee of Refugee Affairs. There's no indication about who would have that oversight role in the current Act, sure my colleagues will elaborate further on those two issues, and I've read some excellent submissions, especially I'd like to point to Williams and the manifesto he founded, and will give you a real clear indication of the problem with these two issues. The fact that this new review process of manifestly unfounded by the DG, and also the standing status determination committee, two areas that were clearly made to somehow alleviate the problems that are experienced, that we're experiencing at the ground level at refugee reception offices with implementing the act. But there's really no indication, unfortunately, how this will repair or make the situation better. A couple other points of concern that we picked up in this new bill was the definition of a dependent. We're pleased to note, actually, that there has been the inclusion of the phrase who is dependent on him and her. So in a sense, the dependent definition seems to have been expanded. But in another sense, the bill, to our reading, seems to have narrowed the definition of the word dependent, as it deleted the word includes and inserted the term means, which connotes a closed list of possible dependent types. And to our reading, this new definition clearly excludes members of the extended family, and in the context of the reality of refugees' flight from their country of origin, this can be seen as a serious omission. The last main area of concern, which we are strongly opposed to and want to make it very clear that there is a lack of understand or lack of congruity between this bill on this point and the international conventions on refugee law at the international and regional ones, the OAU convention as well. In terms of the issue of the removal of serious non-political crime, this bill has amended the act and does not provide the necessary clarity with regard to this important issue of possibly excluding a person from refugee protection on the grounds of non-political criminality. In the 2008 act, we were in fact quite pleased that the department had changed that exclusion clause to comply with Article 1F of the 1FB of the 1951 United Nations Convention on Refugee Protection, and it made sense to keep it in line with that. Right now, as the act now what happened? The bill has reverted from that position, and by deleting the word serious non-political crime, stating that a refugee could be excluded if he or she committed a non-political crime, which if committed in the Republic would be punishable by imprisonment, allows for overly strict interpretation on this issue, which is completely improper in our opinion. There is the real possibility, if you read this section of the bill as it stands, to exclude refugees from South Africa, exclude providing protection to genuine refugees based on the perception that if they committed any crime in their country, that would be punishable by imprisonment, that they could not get the protection of the government of South Africa. We know that you could be imprisoned for contempt of court. You could be imprisoned if you haven't paid your traffic fines. That is just... It is a clearly misunderstanding on our part why the department has reverted from this position, which we thought was appropriate in the 2008 Act, where they referred to the proper wording of that exclusion definition. On that last point, we just would urge the department to amend its wording of the Act to revert back to the 2008 Amendment Act wording in terms of that exclusion based on serious non-political crimes. I think I've gone through my submissions and raised my four main areas of concern, and we welcome the opportunity to respond to the committee members. members about any questions they may have at this time.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Members, your opportunity for comments, questions. You do have a copy of the written submission, and I'm sure the issues that are directed at the department's officials are here. They are noting those issues, and also see parliamentary law advisors welcome, and state law advisor. They are all present. So members, we have a very tight schedule today. So if there are questions, comments, if there are none, I'll move to the next submission. But you have all the records of this. I see no takers, I see no hands, nor do I see any feet.
Can I ask if the department could respond? If we have no questions thus far, because my questions,
no.
Our questions were very much directed to the department and their intentions on the drafting.
May I assist you?
Thank you, sir.
You would not be able to, it's not for the department to respond at this stage. Public hearings, the intent and purpose is to take commentary, suggestions for the public to be able to flag the issues that they are not happy with the intended legislation. So it does not give you the opportunity to engage with the department. At the requisite time when we have taken public comment, then members of parliament will engage the department in regard to all the issues raised by stakeholders. So at that stage in the proceedings, your questions will be adequately covered. And at that stage, the public stakeholders would also be welcome to come to the said meeting. Having said that,
if I may, we're going that. Thank you. The presenter was well articulate on issues across the board, but the only clarity which I think to have is on the removal of serious non-political crime. Now, I just want to show an example. We're in a situation where people commit crimes in their own countries and come to South Africa because they're running away from such countries. That's what a very clear example, which I'm not necessarily going to comment on. Where people have killed individuals from their homeland, coming to South Africa because they are running away of those from the and claim asylum when they get here. Now, you're saying that is not a serious non-political crime, but that's fine. So the issue here is, what do you think, in your view, we should be doing? Because we need to ensure that once we're dealing with these laws, but again, we don't create an environment where our very own people, or the South African citizens, who may find themselves languishing in a sea of threats from these people who may be, you know, unwanted elements in the particular field that we're trying to deal with. So if you could please respond to that. Tepesin, I think here we obviously as a committee have a lot to deal with, and afterwards we see what's best for the people. But if you could please assist me, thank you.
Thank you, member. There are no late takers, so you may respond to them.
I'm sorry if I might not have been so clear. The point is that the international conventions on refugee law that South Africa has signed, the 1951 convention and also the 1969 OAU refugee convention, are specific in the way that they kind of exclusion clauses for refugees who had committed either serious political crimes or crimes that could be seen as a threat to South Africa. It is clear in those legal prescriptions that South Africa has signed to, and it was also clear in the 2008 Amendment Act that South African law abided by those concepts in international law. And just to be a bit more clear, those concepts provide for the exclusion of refugees on the basis of various factors if it can be proven that a refugee has committed a serious non-political crime in their country of origin, and you can measure that by whether it would be an imprisonable crime, but that's a measurement for the decision maker to make. That person would possibly be excluded. In the method that you determine refugees and apply the exclusion clause, you actually include somebody and determine whether they are a refugee and see whether there are any reasons that somebody may be excluded. The way the wording of this bill has reverted to an exclusion which would necessarily, on the strict reading of the bill, which is a very narrow interpretation of this exclusion clause, would mean that any refugee who's committed a crime, if they committed that crime in South Africa, would be liable for imprisonment, can be excluded. And there are many crimes which we are saying are not serious crimes. So this doesn't compart with the international conventions and our obligations in terms of those conventions. Does that make sense?
Thank you. Good folks, shall we thank the University of Cape Town Clinic? Thanks for your submission. We do have it. If we need to revert to you on any issue, we'll do so. We now move to fourth. Migration studies. Vince, welcome.
Thank you, members of the committee, for giving me a chance to speak to you. I just want to point out, FMSC has signed on to the more specific recommendations as far as the human rights that are going to be addressed next. But what I wanted to do was provide some context as you consider these amendments, as you consider what needs to be done to fix the system. FMSP has conducted a review of status determination decisions from all of the refugee reception offices, and what we found was widespread failures in the status determination process. These problems are outlined in the report that was attached with our submissions, and it's also available on our website. I'm just going to highlight a few of the key problems and make some brief suggestions about what can be done through the legislative process. Remedy this. The refugee system is meant to operate separately from the immigration system and is intended to fulfill a different purpose. But the current status determination system is effectively operating as a system of immigration control, and operating as a very procedurally unfair system of immigration control. Refugee law is intended to be fundamentally about protection, and the refugee system as it's currently operating is not providing protection to those individuals that were established to protect, which is those individuals who are fleeing persecution. In a review of over 300 status determination decisions, we found that none of the decisions fulfilled the constitutional guarantee of administrative justice. None of them properly implemented the law, and virtually none of them would stand up to legal scrutiny in a court. Some of the problems that we discovered were serious errors of law, where individuals are being improperly denied refugee status because the status determination officers are getting the law wrong. Most of the status determination decisions are cut and pasted decisions that are not based on individual status determination. So individuals with different claims are receiving wholly identical decisions. They get decisions that have information on the wrong claimant or on the wrong country, and they get very generalized decisions that do not issues the plan. A lot of these decisions also rely on outdated, inaccurate, and irrelevant country information that is haphazardly cut and pasted without any analysis or context. So you end up with very poor quality decisions that don't meet the standards of procedural fairness and are often incoherent. Many of the decisions don't have reasons. The reasons are either absent altogether or they're just very inadequate generalized reasons. The status determination officers base their decisions on irrelevant factors and don't actually consider what's happening in the country. And there's no well-reasoned decision-making as required under the constitutional guarantee of administrative justice. So status determination is effectively not taking place and the system is not fulfilling its protective purpose. Also, they're producing decisions that are so poor that it's impossible for the Refugee Appeal Board to conduct a proper review. So the result is a more inefficient system because the appeal board has to hear all the cases anew rather than just considering the appeal. This is also particularly problematic with the manifestly unfounded decision where there's no right of individual appearance. I think this suggests the need for fairly detailed legislative requirements in order to create a properly functioning system. So some of the legislative changes that can be made include the following. The first is getting rid of the target. Under the current system, the status determination officers have to interview 10 people a day and issue 10 decisions a day, which results in very short, cursory interviews and no time to issue a proper decision. So outlawing the use of targets if you establish the status determination committee could be very effective. Also outlawing same-day adjudication, where the status determination committee conducts the interview and issues the decision on the same day, so that there's really no time for a deliberative process, there's no time to conduct proper research and make a proper decision. By the same token, you could legislate the manner in which the status determination committee should operate, including proper procedures for conducting an interview and reaching a decision to ensure that there is a fair and deliberative process. This could include legislating a checklist of procedures and questions that should be covered during the status determination interview that aren't being covered currently. Also legislating the key elements that should be contained in a proper status determination decision so that these decisions can be reviewed properly, including a full description of the applicant's claim and a well-reasoned decision that is not just generalized cut-and-pasted information, but that considers the particulars of the individual claim. Also very important to legislate a set of monitoring and review procedures to ensure that every decision meets the minimum standards of procedural fairness as outlined in the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, and to ensure that every decision provides a proper basis for review during the appeal procedure. And that would also require eliminating the current review procedure where only positive decisions are being reviewed. And finally, legislating mechanisms to ensure that DHA is accountable when its systems fail to operate correctly and when individual rights are violated, including clear lines of authority and responsibility when legal obligations are not carried out. Right now, the system isn't working and no one is being held accountable. Again, I just want to emphasize, I think there's a need for quite detailed legislation because so far, DHA has been concerned primarily with efficiency and with processing as many people as possible, and there hasn't been any effort to address these more substantive problems. So I'll stop there, and thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. We did circulate your report probably 2 weeks ago. A week ago, which speaks to the issues that you raise in greater detail. Honorable members, comments, questions, areas that are not so clear. Honorable member, love more.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, I read the report and found it rather shocking. So I'm presuming that the report doesn't contain the recommendations that were verbatim made now. They are contained within the report, however. So I just want to clarify that the report actually forms part of the submission on the bill. And then, Chair, I would just like perhaps a little expansion on the matter of serious areas of law that are currently. What the letter says, it says state determination officers are not adequately trained on the law. Now, at the moment, they have a standing committee that they can go to, and they can consult on, in theory, consult on matters of law. That is going to be removed. And I would just like clarity on the stand with respect to that, the serious areas of law that are occurring. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Member Kibet.
Well, thanks, Honourable Chair. I can see that there are concerns about the determination committee. And I think the point which, in my view, seems to be flowing into one paper would be the issue around legal expertise in the committee. And if one has to use the issue here around the serious error of law, if you look at the last sentence there, it says individual who escaped after being detained and brutally tortured as a result of their political belief, for example, and been told that they suffered no persecution. I don't understand how the legal expert can be able to determine what the sentence is in the mouth. I would have thought that it's a matter of medical, people who are medically trained to determine whether a person has or has not been tortured. I'm making this point just to illustrate that maybe too much emphasis on the legal expertise might miss the point. Because there are other aspects, other skills, a combination of all those factors that might constitute that committee. So my view, therefore, is I think too much emphasis on legal expertise, much as in principle it's okay, it's fine. It might miss the point, because we really have to spread our wings to ensure that in that committee, do have as much skills as possible to deal with a number of issues. But I can see there's too much bias on legal expertise. Much as I agree with that, but I think we should really put more focus as if it's only the legal expertise that can resolve all matters in relation to this.
We thank you. Unalert. Ma'am, we are in your ambulance. You may have your opportunity for a rejoinder.
On the issue of legal expertise, I just want to point out, I think there are two issues. There's the issue of the legal question, and then the legal question ties into the issue of credibility. And credibility is really, do you believe the story that the refugee is telling? And the standard is really, is that there's a likely probability that the refugee may suffer harm. There's not an overwhelming burden on the refugee to show to a degree of no doubt that they suffer persecution, but is it likely that they did and that they will if they return? And that's a standard that's been found in international law and it's been established by our court. But the point that I was trying to make is that the status determination officers are improperly using the concept of persecution. They don't understand what persecution is. They don't understand what the requirements in the law are. So even if they believe somebody's story, they will say that person didn't suffer persecution when, according to the legal standards, that person did, in fact, suffer persecution. Another major problem with the errors of law is that they don't understand properly Section 3B of the Refugees Act, which establishes that a person who has fled general conditions of instability or civil war is entitled to refugee status under South Africa's refugee law. The status determination officers were consistently getting that wrong. In fact, they were citing British law stating exactly the opposite proposition, that a person who flees from such circumstances is not entitled to refugee status, and that directly goes against what is found in South Africa's refugee law. Other concepts that they got wrong are some of the core concepts of refugee law, such as well-founded fear, credibility. They were using the wrong standard of proof a lot of times, despite the fact that South African courts have been very clear about what the correct standard of proof is. They were requiring a much higher standard of proof. I'd also like to make the point that even if individuals are properly trained on the law, if they're not given the proper time and the proper resources to be able to conduct these status determinations, the problem is going to remain. So if you tell someone that they have to interview 10 people a day and issue 10 decisions a day, it doesn't matter how familiar they are with the law, there's no way they're going to be able to do anything other than a cursory 10-minute interview and a cut-and-paste decision. So I think there needs to be training on the law, and there also needs to be adequate resources and capability to conduct a proper status determination.
You are covered, Ms. Lafmore, that the report, you haven't spoken directly to that.
Yeah, I would like for the report to be included as part of the
thank you. Any further comment, honorable members? There being none, I just want to flag a general issue which has not come up directly in terms of the focus of discussions has been in regard to the law pertaining to refugees and what we understand by refugees. I would also like you to think of the broader issue. There's economic migration, so that in many instances, or quite a high percentage of the issues being dealt with under the ambit of refugee law also pertains to economic migration. Somewhere in the equation, this has to be discussed and foregrounded. Not an issue that we can ignore. It's a reality. There's instability in country X. I might not be qualifying to be a refugee, but the situation is such that I seek better opportunities next door. A broader question. Nobody has raised it, no one has said anything about it, but it's a reality. It's the elephant in the room that nobody speaks to. I would like to thank you and your other colleague, if there's any other colleague, or if you are a one-person mandate carrying Wits University, well done. We thank you for your input. The committee secretary, I must get this right. Eddie reminds me that years ago there were committee clerks in 1994 when some of us came to these corridors of power. So he reminds me now and then, chairperson, not committee clerk, secretary. The committee secretary informs me that is it Lawyers for Human Rights? Yes. No, wait, ma'am. informs me that lawyers for human rights are on the way to this end. So they are not yet here. So I resist telling you something about being on the way, how indeterminate that is. So in view of that, we will go to this Southern African Catholic Bishops Conference to have their input. So we thank you. And nobody is going to complain about gender bias in the presentations. It's greatly appreciated. We are in your ambulance.
Thank you. And I'd like to say at the outset that the Church encourages the ratification of international legal instruments that aim to defend the rights of migrants, refugees, and their families. And through its various institutions and organizations, offers its advocacy that is becoming more and more necessary. The South African Catholic Bishops Conference and the Pastoral Greenery Center of Cape Town welcome this opportunity to engage with the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee on Home Affairs on this important and pressing matter. We would also like to add that the submission has the support and endorsement of the Jesuit Refugee Relief Services, an international Catholic organization active in South Africa with a mission to accompany, serve, and advocate on the rights of refugees and other forcibly displaced persons. The Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa has also endorsed the submission, and many of those organizations are here today. Throughout history, refugees and all people in need of refuge have been the concern of the Church, and much of the ministry of the Church all over the world is to refugees and others who have been forced to leave their homes. Indeed, we recall that Jesus and his family were refugees and were given refuge in Egypt, a land not of their own. In our own history, we recall the many countries, Zambia, Angola, Swaziland, Lesotho, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe, to mention but a few, that welcomed and granted asylum to so many of our countrymen and women during the long struggle against apartheid. Certain aspects of the Refugee Act of 1998 and the subsequent amendment of 2008 have been found wanting and are certainly in need of further amendments. While the amendments posited in this bill are largely technical in nature, we do have some general comments. This amendment bill has captured the public imagination and the intense interest of organizations working with refugees, including many based within the Catholic Church. This is indicative of the desperate need for legislation and procedures that address the plight of refugees and effectively provide for their safety, health, and general well-being. Relief services provided by the Church continue to experience great difficulty in accessing support services for refugees. There was a hope and a perception that this amendment bill would address many of these issues, but it does not. We know that the Immigration Amendment Bill and the South African Citizenship Amendment Bill have also been before this committee, and it is our hope that the articulation of these pieces of legislation will result in greater clarity and better service delivery. Matters regarding refugees are not only the concern of the Department of Home Affairs, but other departments, including the Departments of Health, Social Development, Justice and Constitutional Development. And education. Such an intersectorial approach requires training of the various officials involved in the day-to-day administration of matters regarding refugees. Such training should commence as soon as possible so as to ameliorate the plight of refugees and put them in touch with services and resources that are available to them. Such training would help ensure that the already existing bureaucracy is more efficient. Furthermore, neither the Principal Act nor the amendments adequately take into account the immense socio-economic and political changes and consequent migration that has occurred in Africa in the past decade.
this year, 2010, saw the rise of forcibly displaced persons reaching over 43 million worldwide, the highest since the mid-90s. The number of people uprooted by conflict in their own countries rose by 4% to 27.1 million. The majority of refugees have been refugees for 5 years or longer, and 4% of all refugees and asylum seekers are below the age of 18. In 2009, 18,700 unaccompanied minors and separated children sought asylum. South Africa was the single largest asylum destination in the world, followed by the USA. South Africa received 220,000 out of the 922,000 applications worldwide. This complex articulation of different forces, as well as the continued decline in the material circumstances of many South African citizens, has resulted in the polarization of citizens and refugees. Indeed, the term refugee has become a pejorative term, and for many refugees, South Africa has not been a place of refuge. We welcome the bill in that it amends the Refugee Act of 1998 and the Refugee Amendment Act of 2008 in order to clarify how applications for refugee status, which are rejected as manifestly unfounded, should be dealt with, and to improve certain definitions. The new definitions of manifestly unfounded in clause 1C and F are an improvement on the previous definition. We welcome the clarity of the proposed definition of biometrics and hope that this will help with the identification of children, which has been a matter of considerable difficulty. While in this point, it's our experience that the A4 paper document containing refugee status is not very durable, and we suggest an alternative form of document be explored, similar to a driver's license or credit card. As the registration of refugee status becomes more efficient and technological, such a card would interact well with such systems and could contain the biometric information as set out in the definition. We also welcome the extension of the term dependent to include a refugee who is dependent on him or her, as this would include unaccompanied minors and other vulnerable persons for whom the segment refugee may have assumed responsibility during the chaos and confusion that characterize conflict and the flight therefrom. Clause 5 stipulates a period of 1 month within which a child of refugee parents who has been born in South Africa must be registered in terms of the Birth and Death Registration Act so as to be concluded as a dependent of such an asylum seeker or refugee. This period is unrealistically short given the present capacity of Home Affairs and the reality that so many refugees and asylum seekers are themselves unregistered and are not always able to obtain much needed administrative assistance. Nothing should detract from the principle that children of refugees who accompany their parents, unaccompanied minors, and children who are refugees who are born in South Africa should be regarded as having the same rights as children of South African parents. Failure to register a child's birth of stipulation, clause 5, should not stand in the way of this principle. In conclusion, we would like to say that Catholic social teaching holds a position where it sees the state's duty to regulate migration into the country as being secondary to the consideration of the common good. This holds that states are morally bound to protect and provide the basic human rights of both their citizens and the resident aliens. At this point, my colleague Lena is going to talk about her practical experience at the Celebrini Center.
Good morning. I'm going to speak on behalf of the Celebrini Center. We have been running a children's home for the past 5 years for refugee and migrant children, and so our submission is based on very practical experience. The experience in accompanying the children in our care and additional individual cases of foreign unaccompanied minors has provided us insight into how South African state departments, that is the Department of Home Affairs and Social Development, are dealing with unaccompanied minors. Unfortunately, our experience has given us reason for concern about certain practices, and the lack of knowledge of the rights of children and awareness about the particular protection needs of those children among state officials has led us to want to express those concerns in a submission, hoping that they will be considered in the Refugee Amendment Act. Mainly, I would like to emphasize on 2 points. One is that there's no clear procedure to document unaccompanied foreign children. The second is that the environment and way in which unaccompanied minors are dealt with at the Department of Home Affairs is not child appropriate. With regards to the first point, we experience currently that unaccompanied foreign minors who access the refugee reception office are frequently being sent away without being attended at all, simply being told that no minors can be registered. Not referring them to the appropriate institution either results in children being sent around from one institution to the other without receiving appropriate assistance, or in remaining without any documents at all. This leads some minors to giving a wrong age, pretending to be older than they are in order to get documents. Wrong documents or not having documents at all puts children in a high-risk situation of being exploited or detained and prevents them from accessing their rights in institutions such as educational or health facilities. If unaccompanied minors are attended, the environment and way in which they are dealt with appears not to be child appropriate. What I mean with this is that, for example, the form BI-5090, which every asylum seeker needs to fill in, is not suitable for children. It contains questions such as the currency of the home country, the national anthem, or political parties of the home country, which are obviously not being created or designed for children that can hardly read and write. The difficulties in filling in this form result in difficulties to provide relevant information in order to take a decision of the children's basic determination. Furthermore, we experience that minor children are made to sign asylum documents, or adults are being asked to give their own fingerprints on the child's behalf, which then leads to confusion at a later stage in the determination process. In our experience, refugee status determination offices don't like to take decisions on cases of unaccompanied foreign minors. That's why they tend to extend the Section 22 of those children until they turn 18, which in our opinion is a violation of the rights of children. Furthermore, we would like you to take into consideration that a child who just arrived in South Africa, having fled a war and who may have experienced violence by uniformed soldiers, maybe, or other officials, a child who does not speak English and may not understand what is going on around him, may find the rough atmosphere at the refugee reception office frightening. If this child is then being questioned about his or her past and potentially being asked to repeat traumatic experiences, like, for example, the loss of family members on way to South Africa, may provoke a re-traumatization. Due to these points, we recommend that the Refugee Act be amended in a way that enhances the protection of unaccompanied minors. We therefore suggest that, above all, one institution should be legally responsible to ensure that a child be documented. And this could be either the Department of Social Development, Home Affairs itself, or the Children's Court. We furthermore recommend that if a child who appears to be unaccompanied and therefore in need of care approaches a refugee reception office, that the Department of Home Affairs itself should be the one to ensure that this child be brought to a social worker in the district where he or she appears to reside. The social worker should then assess the circumstances and determine the need to open a children's court inquiry for the child with the aim to assign a legal guardian through the children's court. We suggest that the children's court be the institution to to give the responsibility, sorry, we suggest that the children could be given the responsibility and mandate to order that the legal guardian or a social worker needs to assist the child in obtaining a legal document. If the child appears to qualify for refugee status, then the children could make further order that the child be taken to the refugee reception office. If the status determination process of the child results in the child's asylum application being rejected, we suggest that the matter must be referred back to the children's court, who may then order that the child be documented alternatively. At the moment, there's no provision being made that for a child whose application gets rejected. If the children's court determines in the beginning that the child does not appear to qualify for refugee status, for example, in the case of children who come from non-refugee sending countries like Namibia or Zambia, etc., the court may order that the child be documented alternatively. Here I would like to mention that, according to our knowledge, there seems to be a gap in legislation to document unaccompanied foreign minors who do not qualify for refugee status, like the ones that I've just mentioned from peaceful countries. And we therefore recommend that a provision be made to document those foreign minors in a way that does not correspond to the typical refugee, non-refugee category in the form of a separate documentation process. Due to this gap in legislation, we are aware that there are a number of children in South Africa that are simply here without any documents because there are no documents that they can actually apply for. Finally, I would like to recommend that the status determination process of the child's asylum application should be child appropriate in the following terms: that a social worker must be present at all times at the Department of Home Affairs, that preferential treatment shall be given to the child as well as to other vulnerable groups such as elderly and disabled, for example, by avoiding them that they have to wait in queues, because we know that some children's homes don't take the children, for example, to the refugee reception office because they don't have the capacity to spend a whole day or maybe several days waiting in the queue for one child while they have other 30 children waiting at home. Furthermore, we suggest that the asylum application form must be appropriate to a child's understanding of the matter by, for example, avoiding questions of the currency of the home country, and that the interview must be sensitive to a child's condition. We therefore recommend that Home Affairs staff be trained in attending unaccompanied minors in a sensitive way and in being aware of the special protection needs of unaccompanied minors so that they avoid simply sending children away without attending them at all. Thank you.
We thank you very much, ladies, for your submission. I must apologize to those who are seated on the floor. Next time, if you see there's a keen interest in what we are discussing today, we should have had a much bigger venue to accommodate everyone. So I apologize to those who are seated on the floor. There's nothing that we can do about it at this stage. Honorable members, by the way, comments, questions? Honorable Lovemore.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, in the submission, there are a number of general comments, and then it goes into the specifics of the bill. In the general comments, there are comments like, and I'll read them now, but the reason why I'm bringing them up is because I don't see in when the submission addresses the specifics, I don't see those comments reflected. And an example is, relief services provided by the church continue to experience great difficulty in accessing support services for refugees. There was a hope and perception that this amendment bill would address many of these issues, but it does not. And then you also talk about what you call an intersectorial approach with the Departments of Health, Social Development, Justice, and Constitutional Development and Education. But with respect to the assistance provided to refugees, that is currently done largely through the church, and with respect to sort of interdepartmental functioning, you haven't provided, and I'd be very interested in your ideas, you haven't provided any submission on what exactly you would have liked to have seen in the bill, what specifically you would have liked to have seen in the bill that would address those general concerns. Thank you.
I thank you, Honourable Lovemore. Members, may Honourable Matele.
Thank you, Chairperson. Mine is just a concern about this legislation of for citizenship. Also, for some children, parents are feeling in a waiting list to be deported. And the child is then gone or living in that particular account. Is that child also entitled for type of that account?
Thank you, Honourable Member. Honourable Bete Masalamu.
Thank you, Chair. It's a question, but it's a little bit complex. I'm looking for ways to phrase it. It's a fact of life that religious institutions with regard to these issues are playing a very important role, and it's very encouraging. But at the same time, it's very difficult to draw a line. The last time I remember when we were debating about human trafficking, I'm not sure how do we separate this refugee movement and human trafficking issues. I'm not very sure, but there is a very thin line. It was discovered, I'm not very sure whether I should mention names of religious institutions. In two countries we have been to, in the Oceanic region as well as in the Americas, it was discovered. If this is not relevant, Chair, you might as well stop me very quickly. Certain religious institutions taking part in human trafficking. So there is a very thin line to draw between refugee movement and human trafficking in certain parts of the world. It also includes sex slavery as well as gun running. You find it very difficult to draw the line. As I said earlier on, it is appreciable that you find religious institutions playing this kind of role, which is very encouraging. But at the same time, it was also proven that they also take part in illegal activities when it comes to human trafficking, sex slavery. It was proven, but the authorities keep on denying it, but it's keep on coming back. So I'm not really sure what I'm saying, but I'm trying to say something, but I'm not very sure whether this is the correct platform, but somebody should help me. Because these are real things, real stories. And authorities keep on denying. I don't know, Chair. Somebody should. Where are state law advisors? How do we draw the line?
Honorable members, I get paid for assisting you. So I'll have to justify why I get paid as the chairperson. There are many broad, important issues that we could be discussing. But for today, what I would like you to concentrate on, we have presenters, they make presentations. Let us interrogate those presentations as closely as possible. I'm not detracting about with regard to the broad issues that might be linked, but what I'll request today is let us focus. Presentation is made, let us interrogate the said presentation so that we can move forward. The other issues, they won't follow the agenda. The only unfortunate thing is that I've got limited time until lunchtime for us to go through all these presentations to seek to give stakeholders the opportunity to interact with this process. So as far as possible, we'll try and do justice to all the issues that you raise. But I'll just plead for that focus. Honorable Kibeti. Thank you, Honorable Member. May I give the presenters the opportunity for a rejoinder?
Thank you very much for your question. About the intersectorial approach, I saw that we have been quite clear in our suggestion that we would like to see a closer collaboration between Home Affairs and the Department of Social Development. And our suggestion was to have a social worker present at the refugee reception office who could then take care of unaccompanied children. Or if that's not possible, maybe to have a person assigned at the refugee reception office to take care of the children who could then make sure to take them straight to the respective Department of Social Development where the child is staying.
I know I'm probably out of order, but yes, I do understand that. That certainly is in the submission. But that comes within the process. It's not something that is covered in the bill itself. I mean, the bill is not going to cover that sort of process.
bill could be more explicit in assigning the responsibility to one institution to take care of this matter, because at the moment it's very vague and unclear of who actually has to take the first step and who has to make sure that the child be documented. It's unclear, so that's why the department can easily just send the child away to another institution. I'm grateful that you brought up the topic of human trafficking, because I think we should bear in mind that every unaccompanied child is potentially a victim of human trafficking. And by not documenting children and by sending them away, whether they are refugees or non-refugees, I think we run the risk of not protecting them. So I think that should definitely be considered. With regards to the operation of the Children's Court is operating on its own at the moment, and I think it only takes a decision to assign a legal guardian once a social worker approaches the court with this demand. Basically, it's not in no way linked to the Department of Home Affairs.
Thank you. I'd just like to say that we are not evicting those who are seated. We are elevating their status. There's a public gallery on top as well. So, we take on board the concerns flagged and raised, and whatever legislation that we draft at the end of the day, we'll seek to deal with principal issues as much as possible so that to mitigate against children not being covered, as you mentioned, in regard to social workers. But we should also bear in mind that the law will not be able to go into all the details. This is why there are regulations, as long as we ensure that all these sectors are covered. Are there any further points that you would like to make before I move on to
the other? Maybe just a final comment. I mean, in our experience, there are no regulations that regulate these issues that I spoke about. So that, I mean, if regulations could be put in place, it would be good. And with regards again to the Children's Court, it is dealing with unaccompanied children, I think mostly South African unaccompanied children. And we just thought that the Children's Court could be a useful institution to deal with the matter of foreign children as well. But then the court would need to be maybe also made aware of this particular responsibility.
I would just like to say that in South Africa, the court is the upper guardian of all minors, not only South African children. So we should also bear that in mind. So there's responsibility there. Doesn't speak about South African children. The upper guardian of all minors. So it might be an issue that we need to look into as to enforcement. If there's no further comment from you two ladies, I would like to thank you for your input. Are you covered now? Thank you. I just need to check. Those in the public gallery, although you have been elevated, I see you standing now. What happened to all the seats up there? Oh, okay. They are waiting for a key to enable them to sit. So in the meantime, you'll observe proceedings from the
apologies for our late mistake. Lawyers for Human Rights welcomes this opportunity to make submissions to the Portfolio Committee for Home Affairs on the Refugee Amendment Bill. Our submission has been endorsed by, has received 12 endorsements, and I would like to read out the organizations that have endorsed the submission. The University of the Witwatersrand Forced Migration Studies Program, the Consortium for Refugees and Migrants in South Africa, the Center for the Study of Violence and Reconciliation, the Trauma Center for Survivors of Violence and Torture, the Coordinating Body for the Refugee Community, Stalabrini Center of Cape Town, the Socio-Economic Rights Institute, Christians for Peace in Africa, Jesuit Refugee Services, the Black Sash, the University of Cape Town Law Clinic, and Section 27, incorporating the AIDS Law Project. In our submission, we have made reference to the present amendment bill, the 2008 amendment, as well as the Principal Act. In contextualizing our submission within the South African migration and asylum situation, we have certain factors here. In 2009 and for the previous 2 years, South Africa registered the largest number of new asylum seekers of any country in the world, and these were made up primarily of Zimbabweans. And this is according to statistics from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. Lawyers for Human Rights recognizes that the Zimbabwean regularization process will greatly impact on the asylum system by removing substantial numbers of Zimbabweans for whom there was previously no other avenue for documentation. However, in order for the regularization process to be fully and effectively implemented, the deadline for the cutoff date does need to be extended. This will have a direct impact on the asylum system and the so-called unblocking or unclogging of the asylum system. The Portfolio Committee needs to be aware of this intimate connection between the two processes, the asylum system and the regularization process, and of the need for urgent consideration of the extension of the deadline.
The second piece, there's a member.
Our written submission is before you. Our oral presentation does not, it may differ slightly from our written submission, but our written submission is before you.
It's okay, honorable members. You have a submission. The principal issues are covered in that, but in a presentation, there's obviously room for embellishment and aroma to make it a very good presentation. So we appreciate that. Thank you.
And then to move on to the substance of the amendment bill, I refer to Section 1 of the Refugees Act, and this is in the definition of dependence on page 3, if you were following on the submission. We recommend that the definition of dependent be expanded to include a dependent who arrives after the principal applicant. In practice, family members who arrive after the principal applicant are often requested to open separate files, and this creates substantial difficulty and prejudice to dependents in order to receive both an asylum seeker and a refugee permit, even after the principal applicant has been successful in their asylum claim. The definition of dependent should also apply to life partners and persons in customary marriages that have taken place in other countries. In practice, this does not occur and unfairly discriminates on persons who have not undergone a civil marriage ceremony. We have recommended a rewording of the definition, and it is in the block, which you can see. Dependent in relation to an asylum seeker or refugee means any unmarried dependent child or any destitute, aged, or infirm member of the immediate family of such asylum seeker or refugee who is dependent on him or Sally's program from earlier this morning, who commented on this issue. And I refer to Section 1E and in other sections of the Act where there is reference to Status Determination Committee, which will seek to replace Refugee Status Determination Officer. There is no mention in the amendment bill of how this Status Determination Committee will operate, how it will be made up, or how it will make refugee status determination decisions. This is a glaring omission and in the bill, and it is vital information which does need to be incorporated. And then we have a small error in our submission. We refer to the 98 Refugee Amendment Bill. It's actually the 2008 Refugee Amendment Bill, which we're referring to. In the 2008 Refugee Amendment Bill, they were proposed amendments which to date have not come into effect, which established the Refugee Appeals Authority. The difference in those amendments was that the Refugee Appeals Authority was very clearly defined. The amendments detailed the composition, functions, and other relevant operational and administrative information. The same level of detail needs to be incorporated with regards to the Status Determination Committee. Lawyers for Human Rights has serious concerns about the current status determination process and the resulting poor decisions emanating out of this process. We refer the Portfolio Committee to the 2010 research report from Fitz University, which Dr. Amit has already spoken about, so I won't speak any further about that particular report. LHR is concerned about the poor quality of decision-making in the RSD process, and it is not so much that we are concerned about the proposed change from the RSDO to the Status Determination Committee per se, but rather our concern is with the substantive and qualitative process that is involved. Regardless of whether it is an individual or a committee that has the responsibility for arriving at the final decision in an asylum seeker's application, the focus needs to be on the quality of the decision and not on the number of decisions which can be made in one day. Currently, RSDOs have targets of up to 10 decisions per day, which is one factor leading them to make very poor quality decisions. While we understand the rationale for this change and the need for applications for asylum to be dealt with in an efficient, prompt, and less subjective fashion, it is difficult to visualize how a committee will operate more effectively than an individual RSD officer. A committee is also likely to take a longer time to make decisions, so there may be a potential for the RSD backlog to increase. We recommend that the Portfolio Committee does have a look at the BITS report in their consideration of how this new Status Determination Committee will operate. I'm moving on to birth registration and the proposed amendments referring to Section 21B of the Principal Act. This is a very positive change, which, however, which fails to take into consideration the practical difficulties around the registration of births for foreign children. And just to clarify what we're asking for, there is already, in terms of the Births and Deaths Registration Act, a requirement for every birth to be registered within 30 days. We don't have any problem with that, and we feel that it's actually a very good requirement. Well, our concern is, once the birth certificate is issued, for the parent to then go to the refugee reception office, also within the 30-day period, to register this child for a refugee permit, and we submit that it's recommend an extension of time in order for the mother to produce the birth certificate in order to obtain an asylum seeker or refugee permit for the child. Moving on to refugee identity documents, and this is Section 30 of the Principal Act. The issue around access to and the availability of identity documents for refugees has been a challenge for a number of years. The most serious problem with the refugee identity document is that it's not recognized, not routinely and generally recognized by other government departments and state officials, because it looks different from the South African identity document. It's a different color, and the color and form of the document is different. South African ID is a little green book with a number of pages. The refugee ID is a maroon document. And while we are not proposing any changes to the principal act in this regard, we do want to draw the attention of the portfolio committee to the challenges that refugees have with in operating or accessing state services with the refugee ID. Currently, there is just to give you an example, there's currently a lot of difficulties with the new speaker regulations, which have been imposed on banks, which state that refugee permits and asylum seeker permits will no longer be accepted as acceptable documentation for banks for any banking transactions. And this is creating considerable difficulties for asylum seekers and refugees who hold money in the bank and they are currently not able to access these funds. There's a very serious problem. So just to give you an illustration of what the kinds of difficulties with the ID documents. Moving on to travel documents, Section 31 of the Principal Act. We do not propose any amendment to this section. However, we wish to draw the Portfolio Committee's attention to the problems around accessing a travel document. Refugee travel documents have not been available except in emergency cases for over 1 year. There apparently is some technical difficulties at the Department of Home Affairs, and we have no information when these documents will be available, but it is a very serious problem for refugees who would like to travel out of the country. And then moving on to procedures for unaccompanied children's asylum applications, Section 32 of the Principal Act, and I understand that you've already had some discussion on this issue this morning. Lawyers for Human Rights made submissions on the 2008 Amendment Bill to clarify the procedure for unaccompanied children who lodge asylum applications. Section 21A and 21B have been inserted into the Principal Act. However, it is unclear from the wording of the section which department or which officials are responsible to provide assistance to unaccompanied children. And this is currently the precise problem which children find themselves in, as they are turned away from refugee reception offices and directed to officials at the Department of Social Development who are, for the most part, unsure or unaware of how to assist these children. So the Act needs to be more specific about who is responsible to provide this assistance and how these children should be treated in the asylum system. There was a question earlier on about the Children's Court, and the Children's Court is already in existence by virtue of the Children's Act, and it is the responsibility of the Department of Social Development to bring children before this children's court. However, these children need to be referred to a social worker, and this seems to be where the problem is starting in the asylum system. We have suggested a rewording of the section, and it's in the block, section 21A1, and I'm not going to read out the whole section, but I will read out the section 21A1A, where we have made suggestions, which the suggestions for the recommendations have been underlined, where we make a suggestion that any unaccompanied child be issued with an asylum seeker permit in terms of Section 22 by a Home Affairs official and be assisted by a social worker from the Department of Social Development. The other two sections have already been amended or included in the 2008 amendments, and they should come into force when all of the new amendments come into force. So if the section is more specific about exactly which official is responsible to assist the child, that would give greater clarity to the area that we are all currently dealing with. I'm going to move along to spouses and dependents of refugees. It's section 21B1. A person who applies for refugee status in terms of Section 21 and who would like one or more of his or her spouse and dependents to be granted refugee status must, when applying for asylum, include the spouse and the dependents in the asylum application. This section was included or inserted into the 2008 amendment form, and we submit that it is vital for the section to remain as in the current changes, as this is a recurring problem for spouses and dependents who, whether they arrive at the same time or after the principal applicant, to receive permits. This is an ongoing problem. It's still a very serious problem, and there is no clarity on whether or not dependents should receive a permit and how they should receive a permit, and this does need to be clarified asylum system, which appears to be operating reasonably well. The poor quality of decisions by the RSDO makes it impossible for the appeal board to operate strictly in an appeals capacity. Instead, the appeal board must rehear cases in their entirety. The poor decision-making at the first instance is rectified in the appeals process, where an appellant is able to raise new issues and present fresh evidence. These de novo hearings are essential in the protection of asylum seekers. Referring matters back to the status determination committees would increase the already growing RSD backlog. This would result in cases taking even longer to finalize, and moreover, referring matters back to the first decision maker will only be effective if the quality of decision making at that initial stage is improved. In the absence of these improvements, this change will be prejudicial to the asylum seeker. We are also aware that the Refugee Appeals Authority intends to hold appeals without the need for the presence of the appellant. And while this is not contained in this amendment bill, the Deputy Minister Malusi Gigaba has been quoted last week as saying, the Refugee Amendment Bill seeks to speed up the appeals process by decentralizing it and removing the stipulation that applicants must be present at the hearings. These details are not part of the bill. We are concerned that such proceedings will be unlawful and contrary to the spirit of the Constitution and other relevant legislation. And it will also, the poor quality of decisions at the first instance will make it virtually impossible for the Refugee Appeal Board to base their decision on the papers alone without the presence of the appellant. The Constitution guarantees that administrative action will be reasonable, lawful, and procedurally fair. It also requests the right, ensures the right to request reasons. Currently, the poor quality decisions and the reasons issued at the first instance make this approach unreasonable, procedurally unfair, and potentially unlawful. Moving on to appeal and review procedures, Section 25 of the Principal Act, there is a need to clarify the review process which is applicable once an applicant has been rejected. What has been occurring in practice is that asylum seekers receive a rejection from the RSDO. They then have 30 days to lodge their intention to appeal that decision. Their Section 22 permit, however, is extended for a period of 3 months, which is misleading and it leads asylum seekers to think that they have a period of 3 months in order to lodge the notice of intention to appeal. So this leads to appeal notices not being received by the Refugee Reception Office within the stipulated time frame, and the asylum seeker is then obliged to seek assistance with the condemnation application for late filing of the appeal notice. Few asylum seekers are aware that they may seek condemnation for late filing, and they are becoming and could potentially become undocumented at this stage without fully exhausting the appeal process. The effect of this change is that an asylum seeker may be deported after the first rejection, even before they have reached the appeal stage in the asylum system. With the current wording of the Act, an asylum seeker may be dealt with in terms of the Immigration Act even during the 30-day period, which is permitted for a rejected asylum seeker to lodge an appeal notice. So there is a very dire need for some amendments to the current wording of the 2010 Amendment Bill on reviews. Moving on to certification and application for refugee status, looking at the amendment of Section 27 of the Principal Act. In consideration of the length of time which the asylum determination process takes, and in view of the fact that asylum seekers almost never receive their decisions within the 180-day time frame as per the Refugees Act, we submit that the section be reworded as follows. And our recommendation is in the block. Permanent residence in terms of Section 27D of the Immigration Act after 5 years of continuous residence in the Republic from the date on which he or she lodged the application for asylum, if the applicant is subsequently successful in the asylum claim and is granted status, refugee status, advised that he or she would remain a refugee indefinitely. I'm not sure if that is clear or I need to clarify it further. Currently, the process is that you may only apply for certification after 5 years of having refugee status. What we are proposing is that because the decision from the asylum application takes so long, you don't receive it within 180 days. You may wait for 3 years or 5 years or 7 years before you receive refugee status. So what we are proposing is that if you are successful in your application for refugee status, you may apply for certification in order to apply for permanent residence from the date on which you lodged your application for asylum. So if you've been an asylum seeker for 6 years, you get refugee status. You may then lodge an application for asylum based on your 5 years, including that time you've spent as an asylum seeker. I'm going to move on to final rejections and international obligations. Lawyers for Human Rights recommends holding a pre-removal hearing of a finally rejected asylum seeker so that any persons who may be in need of protection but who fall outside the asylum system may still have their protection needs considered. South Africa has ratified the United Nations Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman or Degrading Treatment or Punishment and is obliged to protect persons from being sent to countries where they may face torture, cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. And this would include, for example, persons who face the death penalty in their country of origin or in some other country. For South Africa to hand over such a person without any kind of assurance that they won't face the death penalty goes against obligations which South Africa has signed in the Convention Against Torture. And finally, on UNHCR's advisory role, currently the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees has some kind of advisory role which they may play in the current asylum system. The amendment bill suggests that this section is deleted without providing any reasons for this. It would be in the public interest to know why the section is being removed. Lawyers for Human Rights recommends that the section remains in the bill in light of the valuable expert advice and assistance which may be available to the state and to the Department of Home Affairs from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And that is the end of our submission. Thank you, Mr. Chairperson.
Thank you, ma'am. Honourable members, comment, questions? Again, I start with Honourable Lovemore.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have two questions, and the one relates very generally to the statement, and it's on page 8 of the submission, but it doesn't matter, it's a very general statement, that the Constitution guarantees that administrative action will be reasonable, lawful, and procedurally fair. And it talks about, prior to that, Deputy Minister Gigaba saying that applicants need not be present at the appeal hearing, and you refer to that statement. In the very limited research that I've been able to do since I've been part of this portfolio committee, one of the issues that keeps being raised as a problem is interpreters. And the fact that status determination officers at this stage and committees in the future do not properly understand the people that they are processing and therefore do not treat them fairly. In fact, they might take down detail, even incorrectly, and write what they think they're understanding rather than what the person is actually saying. I don't see in any of the submissions, Chair, reference to interpretation or language because it's not contained in the bill. And but my question for Lawyers for Human Rights is simply whether they would consider reasonable, lawful, and procedurally fair administrative action to indeed imply that. And then the second question is, with respect to the Status Determination Committee, similar concerns have been
very much, Honourable Member, Honourable Mataramul.
Thank you, Chair. Maybe by virtue of the representation by human rights lawyers, it gives you very little space to say very little or nothing at all. My only question about on page 5. I'm not very sure because in my time when I was young, my ID document would need a wheelbarrow to push. Is the problem here the size and the shape and the number of pages or the color of the document? What is the problem exactly? Not be in vain.
trying to get clarity, because it seems to me lawyers and human rights, you know, they have demonstrated their skill to show that they have been part and parcel of, I would say, the struggle by the manner in which they have consulted to make sure that their presentation represents as many organizations as possible. Now, from the point that we're making, especially around the data dissemination committee, strikes me, because one point has been made repeatedly, which in my view might make me to leave this room a little bit confused. Because if there is a suggestion that says, if a committee meets and takes 10 decisions, then those decisions becomes questionable. I think it might be a misunderstanding on my part, but I find it a little bit not convincing to suggest that if such a committee can meet in a day and take a number of decisions, and therefore that makes that committee to be ineffective and irrational in the manner in which. I think this point has been made over and over again. And I think unless if the thinking is that there has to be adequate training and empowerment of such a committee, because we cannot limit the number of decisions that a committee takes. If it is capable of taking I think such a committee must be allowed to take it. So I'm just making a point that I don't want to leave this room with a perception that suggests that if state assembly committee can take more decisions, the number of those decisions automatically make those decisions to be questioned. So I will need further clarity so that at least I am clear in my own mind as to what is the basic argument around the efficiency or otherwise of this committee in terms of the decision.
Honorable Member, we thank you for seeking not to limit the decisions to 9 per day. Honorable Mawunya.
Thank you, Chair. My question is with regard to defendants. Whether, how will this, or how will the applicant show that, or prove that these people or these people are the defendants? Number one. Number two is with regard to the 3 months extension to make an appeal. In your opinion, what do you think? Is that too much a period? Does it need to be shortened? Or what do you think?
Thank you, Honorable Member. The little Akbar Kiki. Madam.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'm covered by Honorable Mawuni, because my concern is the definition of the defendant. It seems that it will be too open if it includes all what is proposed by the human rights, the lawyers for human rights. I don't know whether it's not going to open group homes, because you will be having people without any certificates, and I can also come and say I'm the wife of the customary marriages. How do you control this? Because it opens the loophole to a lot of corruption if it's going to be allowed.
you, members. May I suggest that at this juncture we give the presenter an opportunity for a rejoinder? Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Firstly, to respond on the issue of interpreters, we do feel that the access to interpretation services is vital in the interview process, and in our submission, we do with the administrative justice, we would include the right to interpreters, and it would imply that somebody should have the right to an interpreter when undergoing their interview for asylum. And then you asked about the status determination committee and the requirements for people who are part of the status determination committee. Certainly legal training would be a requirement, but we would also go with the recommendations which have been outlined in the VIPS report about the minimum standards and how to maintain standards with the coming up with decisions and making decisions in the refugee status determination process. The third question was about the refugee ID, and I think in South Africa, the question raised was about why is colour an issue, and I think in South Africa, we all know that historically colour is a very big issue for us, and the colour of the refugee ID is a problem, and I've illustrated the banking problem already, so I don't think I need to discuss it any further, but the colour and the form of the ID, because it differs from the South African ID, creates problems for refugees in accessing services. Moving on to the fourth question, it was, the Honourable Member asked for suggestions on the Status Determination Committee and how, and if we could recommend, I think what he was asking for was for suggestions on how the Status Determination Committee would operate. And the bill didn't give us really any idea of what they were looking for. So it was very difficult to make suggestions compared to, for example, when they proposed the changes to the Refugee Appeals Authority. There was a whole list of proposed changes of how it would operate, how it would be constructed, who would be appointed, who could not be appointed. Yet with the situation of the Status Determination Committee, there's no information in the bill. So we're asking for some clarity, but if the Portfolio Committee would like suggestions, we can certainly make some suggestions available, recommendations available. And then the fifth question also asks for clarity about the Status Determination Committee, and it's not so much that we have a problem with committees taking a decision. That's not at all what we're saying. What we're saying is that it doesn't actually matter whether it is an individual refugee status determination officer who takes the decision or it is a committee. What we are concerned about is the quality of the decision that's being taken. That is the problem, not who is taking the decision. It's the quality, the substantive process that is the problem at the moment. And it's creating all the difficulties for the Refugee Appeal Board, who needs to rehear matters, because the quality of the decision taking at the first instance is extremely poor. I hope that clarifies that issue for you, sir. What is happening in the current RSD process is that an asylum seeker is interviewed and the decision is issued in the same day, and usually the interview process, which takes place, the duration of that interview is less than an hour. There is usually no research, independent research, country of origin research carried out that we are aware of, or that is able to be carried out if an interview is less than an hour and the decision is issued. So that's what we have, that's our concern about the decision making. The sixth question was about dependence, and how would somebody prove that they have a dependent. Currently in the asylum system, when you arrive and you apply for asylum, you're not obliged to produce any documentation to show who you are, your name and your identity. But what is required is that you complete an application form where you list all of your information and you you do list your family information. Who is your spouse? Who are your children? Who are your dependents? And based on what you've listed in your application, if your spouse or your children subsequently arrive in the country, Home Affairs or the Refugee Reception Office will then look at your application to see if you've listed these family members. If they are listed, they should be issued with an asylum permit or refugee permit, whatever permit the principal applicant has. But this does not happen routinely, and that's precisely the problem we're raising. So if you've listed these applicants in your, these dependents in your application, they should receive a permit if they subsequently arrive in the country. And then the seventh question was also about the definition of dependent, and there was a suggestion that what we proposed was, the definition that we proposed was too broad. And if you look at the definition which has been proposed in the amendment bill, we've only actually included the underlying section to include family members who arrive subsequently. The rest of the section has been proposed in the amendment bill. That is not ours. That was all. Thank you, Chairperson. To lodge an appeal. Currently there's 30 days. The problem which we have raised in our submission is the confusion about how long a person has to lodge an appeal. And the confusion comes about because a person is given 30 days to lodge their intention to appeal, but their permit is extended for 3 months. So there's a confusion. Because they have got the permit extended for 3 months, they also think they have 3 months to lodge the appeal. So we don't per se have a problem with the 30 days, but it's the confusion which is created, which leads to the perception that somebody has 3 months rather than 1 month. So it's more of a procedural problem rather than any kind of substantive change which we want in the bill.
Remember, you have a follow up?
Check on page 2. The recommendation is that the definition of dependent should also apply to life partners and persons in personal knowledge. Now it's not included here, it says appears here on the blog. Dependent includes such family members. I don't know whether the question is referring to customary marriages or whatever. That's why I need to tell you.
Yes, what we are asking for is that if in your application you've listed your customary wife as your life partner, if they subsequently arrive in the country, they should also receive the same permit that you have. Irrespective of whether you have a civil union or customary marriage, if you've listed this person as your spouse, they should receive the same treatment.
Thank you.
these obligations in terms of that convention.